Good morning, I'm Christopher Purdy. Delighted to welcome you all to All Sides Weekend Books, where we talk about what you've been reading. We want to hear from you for your recommendations, and we have some experts with us with recommendations and filled book bags of their own. Cassie Rose is WOSU's book critic and maintains the blog thelongestchapter.com. And Kevin Griffith is a professor of creative writing and poetry at Capital University. And between the two of them, we are pretty well covered, and we didn't talk much about the first three bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list. They're the same as they were last time, 50 Shades of Grey. We all know about it. So let's digress over that and ask Cassie Rose to tell us about something that she has with her that has an OSU connection.
Yes, I have the book The Three-Day Affair with me by Michael Cardos. He is a graduate of the OSU MFA Creative Writing Program, and this is his debut novel published by Mysterious Press. It's a thriller, and I'm only 100 pages through it, but I can tell you that I'm looking forward to spending the rest of the weekend finishing this book. It also got rave forecast reviews. I can tell you it received a starred forecast from Publishers Weekly and from Kirkus. Kirkus does not hand out their stars loosely, you could say. So I am very confident that the rest of this book is going to be just as wonderful and gripping as the first 100 pages. Here is the premise. There are a bunch of guys who went to Princeton together, and they gather for a weekend every year. And this year, it's for in New Jersey, where one of the guys lives. He can't afford the fancy resort. One of them is still, though, in New York. He's busy with his lawyering job, coming late. So three of them go to dinner. They go play some golf. One of them named Jeffrey. Clearly, he's not himself. And as they're driving away, he wants to stop in a convenience store. He goes in and he comes out with the cashier, whom he is gripping, handling, throwing into the back of the car. And the driver thinks, she must be sick. I'm going to drive to the hospital. And you understand that because of something that's gone on in the prologue. Well, about 10 minutes in, the other two guys realize that Jeffrey has kidnapped this girl. These are all regular, upstanding, hardworking businessmen. And so they're in trouble very quickly. And one of them is a congressional candidate. He is running for office. So you can see how this starts to layer.
It's also a black comedy, too, in some ways.
A little bit. But he layers it very well because you can see how you're like, well, why doesn't he just drive the girl back and let him go? And you can see how it gets layered and that they're trapped in. So I'm at the point where they're all at a safe place trying to figure out what to do. And the lawyer friend is saying, I'm on my way. And so probably he's going to figure into this. It is a slick page turner. It's one of those where the dialogue is crisp. It's fast paced. The characters are relatable. They are funny, but they're also very responsible men. I mean, they graduated from Princeton. One of them got into the dot-com industry and became a millionaire, but then lost it all.
I just wanted to make sure we have the title, The Three-Day Affair by Michael Cardos. Isn't there an event coming up this weekend?
Yes, there is. It's starting today, and it is an alumni book fair OSU event going on today, tomorrow, and I think also Sunday. A lot of panels that are going on, book signings. You could meet Michael Cardos at 6 o'clock at Barnes & Noble on Saturday night and purchase the book and get it signed. There are a lot of events going on, and I think if you Google OSU MFA Alumni Book Fair, it'll probably come up and you will see the full schedule. It looks like some interesting
something
panels.
Something to look forward to. We were all discussing before we went on air that September seems to be the month because a lot of things are going on. Let me ask Kevin Griffith, A, what he's brought with him, and B, what maybe he's looking forward to.
Well, we talked about all the big new releases coming out in September this fall, and I was really looking forward to, and I got the copy. An oldie but goodie, The Complete Poems of Philip Larkin. Now, we know Larkin. There have been many editions of Larkin's poems issued, but this has just come out. It's edited by Archie Burnett, who's at Boston University. And this this contains all of his poems, including stuff that he chose not to publish in his lifetime. So that's really interesting. And contains all of his notes about his poems, his personal notes, his letters commenting on the poems, his letters commenting on the drafts. He published only 106 pages of poetry in his entire career, a career that spanned over 30 years. So he was very circumspect about what he wanted to put out there for the public. And that's, to me, that's a laudable thing with a poet, a laudable trait.
Tell me, just give us a little thumbnail of who Philip Larkin was and where he is in the lexicon, if you
will.
Well,
yes.
And why is he so popular? I don't know him as well as I feel that I should, and there's something about him that seems to be...
I'm super excited about Philip Larkin, and I think this generated a lot of interest, and there was a huge reading at Cooper Union in New York City with major American poets reading from this book. I think that Philip Larkin is now going to be seen as the post-World War II British poet of record. I think he's supplanted Ted Hughes, and I think he's one of the few poets really from our century post-World War II who will be remembered in the world. I think people are reassessing the value of his work and re-engaging with him in a way. A lot of people don't like Larkin because he was very acidic in his tone often. It can be off-putting. And it's really interesting to read some of the... His second book, The Less Deceived, which many people think was his first great book, was rejected by several presses, and they said it's too self-pitying, too cynical. And he wrote in response to one of them, he said, well, they rejected me, those editors, they're just priest-ridden little lice. You know, that's what he called them.
But, how did I miss that?
Yeah, well, that's what's fascinating about this book, the collected. It's called The Complete Poems of Philip Larkin.
Now it does make me want to see his notes.
Yeah. Let me read one of his earlier poems of note, though, Talking in Bed, which is just an outstanding poem. It's short. Let me read it to you. Talking in Bed. Talking in bed ought to be easiest. Lying together there goes back so far. An emblem of two people being honest. Yet more and more time passes silently. Outside, the wind's incomplete unrest builds and disperses clouds about the sky. And dark towns heap up on the horizon. None of this cares for us. Nothing shows why, at this unique distance from isolation, it becomes still more difficult to find words at once true and kind, or not untrue and not unkind. And he was never married. And this is a really, I think, telling poem about what happens to people over time in a relationship and the kinds of things we say to each other. And he has a letter from his love interest, Monica Jones, and she said, I'm not sure what to make of Talking in Bed. I don't know if I like it, but one thing's for sure, don't show it to your mother. That's what makes this fascinating.
Well, that would be an interesting title for a memoir.
Yeah, right, right.
Don't show it to your mother.
Yeah.
I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend with Books, and we'd like to hear from you and know what you are reading, and we'll have recommendations for you as well as the show continues with Kevin Griffith and Cassie Rose. 292-8513. That's a 614 number. You can send us an email at allsides@wosu.org, and you can certainly find us on Facebook. 614-292-8513. What is it about? What are you looking forward to that's being published soon? Because we've said September is a busy month, and why? What's really getting you, I can't wait? Is there one that I can't wait to get my hands on?
Ian McEwan, he's coming out with a new novel called Sweet Tooth, and I think it's planned to be released on November 13th. So this is a book that they are relating to Atonement because of the narrator, because of the situation, I think. Although... And don't quote me on this, but my remembrance is that it's about, takes place around 1972. It has to do with a woman who is engaged in MI5 because of her, she's a writer, I think, and something about her literary interest or whatever, but it sounds very, very Ian McEwan and interesting, and I can't wait to get it. Sweet Tooth by Ian McEwan.
And Kevin.
Another one of my favorites. Aside from Larkin, David Foster Wallace. Three books coming out by David Foster Wallace. I just read Conversations with David Foster Wallace, edited by Stephen Burns, which is his complete interviews, and that's a fascinating read to hear what Wallace said. And one fascinating thing is when asked who his favorite poet was, David Foster Wallace unbelievably said, above all else,
Philip Larkin. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and he talked a lot about how Philip Larkin speaks to people, and that's what he wanted to do in his novels. But that's out. A new biography of David Foster Wallace is out, and a collection of essays that were uncollected in his life is coming out soon as well. And so I'm looking forward to those. I think Foster Wallace is the novelist that's going to be remembered post-World War II. So.
Well, tell me why. And give us a little, remind us of his story a little bit.
Well, David Foster Wallace is a fascinating character. He his biggest novel, that novel that everyone should read, and I use in my critical writing class, is Infinite Jest. Infinite Jest is a monster of a novel, over 1,000 pages, 1,079 pages, 300 footnotes. It's basically considered like the Mount Everest of fiction. Everyone should go after it and attempt to scale its heights. And I don't think anything's been done to even rival that in any way.
Is that the posthumous that one?
No, Infinite Jest was done in 1996. The posthumous one was The Pale King. That was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize last year, The Pale King, which is also fascinating. I think people are reevaluating Wallace and seeing him not just as another postmodern trickster or someone who was afflicted with cleveritis, but someone who is really trying to make a statement about the human condition. And we know his story. He was afflicted with mental illness his whole life. His last couple years of his life, he was attempting to get off all drugs that he was taking for his illness, because he said they didn't allow him to feel like himself, and he eventually committed suicide at age 48 in 2008. That's probably contributed to the aura surrounding him. Mm-hmm. But I would strongly recommend, if you have the time and energy, to try to read Infinite Jest. You will learn a lot about that, and it's a fascinating novel. It's funny, it's profound, and it is about the whole problem with people's obsessions with sports, alcohol, drugs, and media.
Media that covers obsession. A wide net,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it's a huge book.
There's something for everybody. We have a call from Ed, who has a recommendation for us, Ed in Columbus. Hello, Ed.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes. Unfortunately, I cannot remember the author's name because I read the book a couple of months ago, but it's nonfiction. It's called Fate of the Republic, and it's about the assassination of James Garfield and its aftermath, and it is just a terrific book. It reads almost like a novel, and a lot of it has to do with it's the antiseptic is just coming in, and doctors don't want to bother with it, what you find out is that had they kind of left Garfield alone instead of, like, poking around on the wound, he probably would have survived. And then there's a fascinating bit in there about Chester Arthur, who took over for Garfield, who, it turns out, was just this party hack that they shoved in there and who really did not want the job. And when Garfield was dying, he was at his bedside almost every day praying that he would survive because
Praying he would recover, probably, yes.
Yeah, yes. And then there's a great, and people are threatening Arthur. They're saying, you know, if you take the office, we're going to shoot you and all this other stuff. And there's this one woman who's an invalid in New York who writes to him and basically says, and this is the only voice he hears that is anywhere near positive, who's telling him, I know that you didn't want or expect this job, but you've got to man up and do it. And there's a great scene at the end when the guy who put him in power, whose name escapes me, is telling Arthur what he's going to do and how he's going to do it. And Arthur and you see the guy just grow in that moment. And he just says, look, I'm the president of all the people, not just you. And I'm the president. I'm not here to do your bidding. And it's just, it's just one of many scenes. I'm not doing the book justice because I focused on that particular facet of it. But there are many facets in the book.
It was
and
a very popular book,
read.
Yeah.
It's very good.
I thank you for the call, Ed. That was one of my favorites of the last 6 or 7 months, the Destiny of the Republic.
The State of the Republic.
And the author's name does escape me, unfortunately. But Google
Garfield,
and you're good to go. We have to take a quick break. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Don't go away. This is All Sides Weekend Books.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 72 degrees with sunshine. Increasing clouds this afternoon, bringing a chance of rain. Temperatures will also be falling as the clouds and chance of rain move in. Clear skies tonight, a little chilly overnight, a low of 48 degrees. Sunny and a high of 74 on Saturday. Clear skies for Saturday night, a low of 48. Support for 89.7 comes from Sherpa Concerts, presenting topical humorist and panelist of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Paula Poundstone, Saturday evening, September 29th at the Lincoln Theater. Tickets are available now at all Ticketmaster outlets. And support for 89.7 comes from the Midland Theater, presenting Here to Stay, The Gershwin Experience, Sunday afternoon, October 14th. Here to Stay is a multimedia concert celebrating George and Ira Gershwin, performing such songs as Rhapsody in Blue, I've Got Rhythm, and many more. Tickets at MidlandTheater.org. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you, our producer, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, here with Cassie Rose and Kevin Griffith. We're talking about books today on this edition of All Sides. You can call us at 614-292-8513 and let us know what you're reading. AllSides@WOSU.org is our email address. You can send us an email or you can find us on Facebook. I have to say, that was a great book about the assassination of Garfield. That was a kind of... The gentleman said it was read like a novel, and Cassie, you were talking about something about to come out that's a historical novel or a nonfiction novel. You said something...
They're labeling it as a nonfiction novel, which seems confusing, but basically what it tells us is it's about a real person, and it is the author is filling in the spaces probably with some imagination. But the book that's coming out, and it's going to come out on September 25th, is called Sutton. And it's by J.R. Moringer, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And it's about a bank robber who is, I believe the name was Sutton, a very famous one, and who became very popular among the people. They were almost cheering him because the banks were so disreputable during this time, the 20s, the 30s. And so on the one hand, they were cheering him while he was breaking the law.
Robin Hood. A little bit of Robin Hood from the 1930s. Mm-hmm. We have Paul from Worthington with a recommendation. Hello, Paul.
Good morning. I'm halfway through a book. I believe it's Donald Ray Pollock, who his first published book was called Knock 'em Stiff, which is about a southeastern Ohio community of that name. This is his first novel, and it is titled The Devil All the Time. I would warn readers, there's some pretty mature subject material in there, but his style is so straightforward. It's very plain spoken, and this guy didn't really get started writing, I don't think, until well into his 30s. But I heartily recommend this book. It's graphic in detail, but it is very, very human in terms of he draws on his knowledge of the people of this part of the country and this part of Ohio, frankly. And I believe he now resides in Chillicothe, which is maybe 13 miles from where he grew up. The only other recommendation I have is, and I think you guys have discussed this, is The Lock Artist. And I'm sorry, I don't recall the name of the author.
Yes.
Steve Hamilton.
Yes.
Yeah.
Paul, thank you for the recommendation. We're going to talk a little bit about Donald Ray Pollock. We spent a lot. He's been here to talk with us.
And he's here this weekend, too. I think he's sitting on some of the panels.
Yep. Another MFA, big MFA graduate. Mm-hmm. And I would second what Paul said about that novel, The Devil All the Time. Excellent novel. Mm-hmm. Knock 'em Stiff. Excellent.
And they're just, rough, though. Yeah. They're unforgiving.
They're brutal. Yeah. And they're an acquired taste, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. But he's got his new novel I have read.
Really?
I must have read an interview or something. Will be set in Ross County, and I believe it takes place in the turn of or in the beginning of the 20th century. So it's not a present day.
But he's an author, not just because we've had him on the studio, but he's worth looking forward to for his upcoming things. So thank you for that tip, Cassie Rose. Jerry's on the phone with a recommendation. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Mr. Purdy. Enjoyable program. By the way, the bank robber was Willie Sutton.
Yes.
And they asked him why he robbed banks. Willie Sutton said, that's where the money is. But several weeks ago, you had someone on that was talking about a spy thriller. Well, let me give you my recommendation for a true nonfiction spy thriller. The Catcher Was a Spy by Nicholas Davidoff. And the catcher was Mo Berg, who spoke six or seven languages fluently. And he had been in the major leagues in the early 30s. Hit home six home runs totally. But anyway, he got, and he worked crossword puzzles in Sanskrit, believe it or not.
Oh, my gosh.
Who knew there were crossword puzzles in Sanskrit?
I don't know, but if you ever read Ernie Harwell's The Game for All America, Mo Berg is mentioned in there. getting back to the story, in World War II, because he was so fluent in several languages, he got in the OSS, Wild Bill Donovan's organization, the Office of Strategic Services. And anyway, they heard that Heisenberg, you know, the German guy that was working on the A-bomb, was giving a presentation in Geneva. So they gave Mo Berg an automatic to tuck into his trousers and said, you go over there, and if you find out that they're anywhere near to breaking this A-bomb thing, you got to dispose of them. This is a true story. So Mo goes over there to Geneva and listens to Heisenberg give his presentation. And not only listens to him, he's so fluent in German, he walks back to the hotel with Heisenberg, and he reports the OSS. They're not anywhere near it. So here's your gun back, in essence.
Jerry, just give us very quickly again the title of your recommendation.
The title is The Catcher Was a Spy.
Very good.
And by the way, I don't know if Nicholas Davidoff made a play on The Catcher in the Rye by Salinger. I don't know, but
That's
have a
clever.
Great weekend, folks.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you. You bet.
Thank you very much for that call. 292-8513 is the number. That's a 614 number. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org or find us on Facebook. Kevin Griffith, I never thought I would see you walk in here with a book by Agatha Christie. God love you. My wife will love you for that because she's such a devotee.
Really? I'll be honest, I'm not an Agatha Christie fan. I don't know why I have this book. Well, I do know why I have this book. I brought this book in to talk about, I'm going to read it, but I wanted to talk about this really, I thought this was a really interesting phenomenon. Did you know this, Christopher? You live in Clintonville as well. But did you know in this age of e-books, Kindles, and libraries disappearing and going digital, people are building little mini libraries in their front yards?
My neighbor on Oakland.
And one on Oakland. There was one on Oakland, and now there's one on Richards, where you can walk when you're out on an evening walk, stroll by. They look like little houses on a post, and you can open the door, and there's about 20 books in there, and it says take one and put one back if you'd like, take one or trade one. And so I often walk back there, and it's really nice. Sometimes you go to the library, get overwhelmed, or you don't have time, or it's after hours, and you can just take a little walk, and your neighbor's got the mini library out of there. So I just randomly pulled out Agatha Christie's by the pricking of my thumbs, which I'm hoping to get through and introduce myself to her work, because shame on me, I haven't read any Agatha Christie, and I'm a mystery fan. But I thought that was wonderful that people are doing that in this day and age. They're trying to salvage the old experience of just wandering into a library and picking up a book. And I'm glad, and I hope more people do it.
There is such a little library on my street, and I'm delighted that my neighbors have put that there, and I have myself indulged. But also, you have a book, a title, which I hesitate to say on the air, but it's so great. I can't.
Well, this is fantastic.
New Ways to Kill Your Mother. Okay.
Yeah, what a
Discuss.
Great title.
Well.
It's got to be one of the best titles of the year, New Ways to Kill Your Mother, but it's actually a very serious work of nonfiction, brilliant, by Colm Tóibín. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Irish author and critic. It's called New Ways to Kill Your Mother, Writers and Your Families. This is an absolutely fascinating book. It's like 10 books in one. He has chapters on almost every writer you can imagine and their relationships to their mother or their father or their children. Thomas Mann is in there, and he talks a lot about the relationship of Thomas Mann with his children, and two of his children committed suicide, and it's just devastating. one of the early chapters is on W.B. Yeats and his father. And, you know, Yeats's father was an artist, but not a very successful artist. And it's fascinating because when Yeats became really big, his father was trying, father was in his 80s, trying to spin off of Yeats's popularity and so began writing plays. And the correspondence they had, he, you know, the father would send his son the play and say, can you read this and just tell me what you think? There'd be silence for like a year. And then finally Yeats would write back and saying, Dad, I don't think you understand how difficult it is to write plays, and I think you should stop, you know. And then just this real awkwardness. And the, one of the last chapters is on John Cheever, the relationship with John Cheever, yeah. Which was just devastating.
Right, to all his
Cheever
family,
was, of course, a closeted gay man, and he didn't have a job. He was just a writer. So he never, this almost seems unbelievable to me, but he never left the house. So his children just deeply resented him. And there's a bit of Susan Cheever writing something in there that in one of his stories, he has a daughter write on the mirror, Daddy, please don't leave us. She writes it in lipstick. And Cheever always claimed that was based on a true event in his house. And Susan Cheever says, I would never write that because Dad never left. He started drinking at 9 in the morning,
right,
sitting
yeah.
by the pool, and he just sat there all day.
Maybe he
writing.
Misread and she wrote, yeah. Dad, get out of here.
Yeah, that's right. But New Ways to Kill Your Mother, and absolutely, you will walk out of this book feeling so smart, so entertained. It's by Colm Tóibín, New Ways to Kill Your Mother, Writers and Their Families.
It's a wonderful Irish writer. His fiction
yes,
is terrific,
his
too.
His fiction yeah. is good.
By the way, I would love to hear from people. If you were going to put a mini library in your front yard, in a little house or whatever, or a little bookshelf for your neighbors, what books would you stock it with? So why don't you let us know that? I'd love to. I'm just curious to know. 292-8513. What would you make available to your neighbors or passersby? 614-292-8513. And meanwhile, Cassie Rose, I'm intrigued by the title and cover of this novel that you came in with by Rachel Joyce.
Oh, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. This is a wonderful book, and it's very engaging. A story about a newly retired British man who receives a letter in the mail from a former colleague, a woman named Queenie Hennessy. And she says that she's in hospice care, and she's writing to say goodbye. And he is just overwhelmed with emotion and writes her a reply. Now, they haven't seen each other for 20 years. And Harold is married, and his wife is very cold and very instructive and always cleaning the house. So he leaves to go post the letter, and he passes by one mailbox and then another, and then he has a conversation with a young girl about faith and about doing something that matters in life. And so he goes to a phone box, and he calls the hospice place and says, tell Queenie Hennessy that I am walking to see her. Well, she's 500 to 600 miles away. And he proceeds to head out. He has no mobile phone. He's wearing yachting shoes, as they call them. He has on a light jacket. And he heads out. And what this is a wonderful metaphor for is he walks away from all the burdens, the restrictions of his home life and his emotional burdens and his material burdens. And she writes this with this wonderful lightness of being. And you just cheer for him. And he then is able to process through his life. And he's a flawed guy. And he's a normal guy. He's like all of us. And he thinks about his regrets and the mistakes he made with his son. And meanwhile, he's meeting all these strangers and having these wonderful experiences with them.
Rachel Joyce, did you know her? Because the book sounds very intriguing, what you just described.
She has been writing for years, but for BBC Radio. This is her first novel. And she also was an actress, I believe, in England. So she has a long career, but this is her first book. Clearly, she did hit the ball out of the park because it was long listed for the Man Booker Prize. I was disappointed to see that it did not make the short list, which was announced on Monday, I believe it was.
Is Hilary Mantel on it again?
Yes, she is.
For Bringing Up the Bodies?
Yes, yeah. She's on
Great
it.
Great book about Anne Boleyn.
Yes.
We have three email messages. Rosa on Facebook is reading Unforgiven by Laura Hillenbrand for her book club. Tom has sent us an email. Another book with a local connection is one about the music business called Hitless Wonder. by, Kevin is nodding, by a member of the local band Watershed, Joe Ostrich, who is a creative writing professor in the Carolinas. It's like Dave Eggers. He said, well worth a read. Hitless Wonder. Do you know the book, Kevin?
I've heard of the book. Yeah, I got a lot of good reviews. Yeah.
And we have a recommendation from Steve, Unbroken, a really amazing story about an Olympic runner, prisoner of war turned Billy Graham follower. Very inspiring. Unbroken. I know that's been on the bestseller list for a long time. We appreciate these recommendations. Tell us more recommendations. And if you were going to make books available to your neighbors for free as they walk by the front of your house, and I'm not asking them to ring the bell. I'm just asking them to walk by. What books would those be? 614-292-8513 or send an email to us at allsides@wosu.org or, like Rosa, find us on Facebook. Virginia in Cincinnati is on the line with a recommendation. Hi, Virginia.
How are you?
Hi, you're on.
Okay, I would suggest The Rise of the Fourth Reich, the secret societies that threatened to take over America.
Oh, okay. Tell us more about that.
Well, it just goes into different secret societies like the Freemasonry and Skull and Bones that some of our presidents have been, a part of. And it talks about 9/11 being investigated. And I kind of thought it was clever that it would be a library outside. That way I wouldn't have to get into any political discussion.
Well, yeah, that would be interesting.
That's a good point.
Sure, yes. Well, Virginia, thank you for the recommendation.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. 292-8513 is the number. It's fun to find authors that have worked in other genres like radio and then, mid-career, make debuts as novelists and things like that.
Well, and in her case, you can feel the refreshing prose, the lightness. And also her lines are very tight. So you know that she's been writing for dialogue on radio, and they speak volumes that other writers would take maybe a paragraph to say.
And I'm going to turn this around because I'm very intrigued. Kevin Griffith is the type that would have a library in the front yard. What would give me some titles you'd throw in there for your neighbors? And this could go one day or another.
I was just that was interesting, that comment from the listener in Cincinnati about what she would put in there. And it is interesting to see when I walk by that mini library on near my house. That's what's fun about it, is some people have gone through and put religious literature in there. It's just a Pandora's box, basically, of all sorts of bizarro stuff. That's what makes it so fun. And there was a really one of my daughter's favorite authors is Wendy Mass. I believe that's her name. She's a young adult writer, and she had been looking for this book and didn't have it, and it was in that box. And so she was just really excited to find that. It was just fantastic. In my box, of course, I probably put a lot of unused copies of my old books in there to get rid of them. That would be good. I think I would do that. One of them I would put in there that I have with me, and I had forgotten what a really great book this was, is Flowers for Algernon Daniel Keyes. What a wonderful book. I had forgotten about this book completely. It was made into a movie called Charlie.
Charlie, right.
But Flowers for Algernon, what a fantastic read. Just an incredibly devastating book. For those of you who don't know it, it's a fantastic book for ages 14 and up. It's kind of a young adult book, but definitely an adult book as well, entertaining. The story in a nutshell very quickly is the main character, Charlie, is mentally disabled individual, but he gets an operation and becomes incredibly smart and engages in research in his own condition. But then this mouse, Algernon, has also been given this treatment, and he notices that the mouse is beginning to degenerate to go back to a state of low IQ. And, of course, he realizes this is going to happen to him as well. And so it's written in diary entries, and initially they're very poorly written misspellings, and they become incredibly prescient and David Foster Wallace-like, and then they go back to being misspelled gradually, and it's brilliantly done. It's a tearjerker. I know it's a little melodramatic, but we all need that once in a while. But it's a fantastic
book. It's a book
read
that a lot of us read in school and probably didn't resent it, but as an adult, it resonates in a different, a wonderful way.
Right.
We have to take a break. We'll be back in 90 seconds. Don't go anywhere. This is All Side Weekend. I'm Christopher Purdy.
HBO's Boardwalk Empire begins a new season Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Michael Shannon, who plays disgraced Prohibition agent Nelson Van Alden. The animated film Chico and Rita, which celebrates the music and culture of Cuba of the 1940s and 50s, comes out on DVD next week. We'll hear from the director, Fernando Trueba. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon. This is 89.7 NPR News, 74 degrees, partly sunny skies. Increasing clouds this afternoon, bringing a chance of rain. Temperatures also falling later today as those clouds and rain move in. Clear skies tonight, a low of 48, sunny and a high of 74 on Saturday. Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Foundation, thanking WOSU and others who make Columbus a smart and open community. At the Columbus Foundation, personal service and community pride combine to help donors help others through impactful philanthropy, big or small. It's here the history resounds and opportunity abounds. Support also comes from the Physicians Free Clinic and Voluntary Care Network, providing charity medical care for Central Ohio's uninsured patients. More about joining the Columbus Medical Association Foundation in supporting the clinic is at goodhealthcolumbus.org. And All Signs Weekend continues.
Thank you, Amy Jurevich, with your reassuring smile through the glass. I'm Christopher Purdy. We're here with Kevin Griffith and Cassie Rose. We're talking about books on today's edition of All Sides Weekend. And we do have Phil on the line from Eureka Park, and I want to make sure he gets in. Hi, Phil.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, the book I'd like to recommend, I may have actually heard about on your one of your previous shows, but it's Double Cross, The True Story of the D-Day Spies by Ben McIntyre.
Oh.
I've read about that book.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, it's a wonderful book. That it's nonfiction, and of course, it covers the spies in World War II and mostly the double agents. And it gives brief profiles of the agents, who range from bored socialites who are just looking for adventure to some very less than reputable characters who either go in for money or because they're blackmailed. And it talks about, you know, it goes into all the deceptions during World War II and, of course, the fears that the British had that some of their agents had been turned, and, of course, them trying to turn many of the German agents. And some of it's almost laughable, the ineptitude of some of the agencies and the spies that are dropped in England that know English at all.
Well, thank you. It's called Double Cross.
Yes.
Thank you, Phil, for the recommendation.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you. 292-8513 is 614 number. Cassie Rose, I have to ask you, you're going to make books available to your neighbors. You're going to get into this trend that we had started here, including one on my street, of people putting books out for their neighbors to pick up on the way by.
You know, when you mentioned this, I got very excited about that. I thought, I hope in Grandview they start that, and maybe I should start it. But also my mind started going to what would I put there, and I'll just tell you what popped into my mind. Saw Bellows Humboldt's Gift, won the Pulitzer Prize. Oh, my gosh. Fabulous book that I remember reading and could not put it down for the incredible, profound message that was in it. What also came to mind was Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried About Vietnam, a haunting, just gripping book. Another book that came to mind, Every Man Dies Alone by Hans Falada.
Oh, that's phenomenal. You recommended that to me, right?
Mm-hmm. Put out by Melville House. And then I also thought of The Collector by John Fowles, which is a very difficult book. But when you think about the books written today about, you know, kidnapping and all of that, I mean, which is what this is about, he did it very well. The psychological drama in that book, The Collector, is chilling. I think also, finally, I would put Mary Oliver poetry, several of her books out there, to introduce people to her beautiful work.
So I can't give your address on the air, but I'm sure a lot of people would like to have it at this point. We have a recommendation from a listener who says, I would put Rick Steves' travel books on my front porch to encourage people to travel, like to walk by my house. No, that's a wonderful idea, because his stuff is terrific. And also, there's a suggestion for light reading. It's called Maisie Dobbs books, which take place in England after the First World War. That kind of is our Downton Abbey tie-in, maybe, going on here. 292-8513. You can also use email at wosu.org. I want to ask you about the blue cover now. John Green.
John Green's. This is a young adult novel called The Fault in Our Stars. It is a runaway bestseller. now, and I can see why. This is a book that caused me to overwater my lawn one night, and another night I was sitting there and I kept coming to the end of the chapters and I kept saying, you've got to go to bed, and I didn't. I just kept reading. It is a difficult subject matter, but because it's young adult, it is uplifted. It is about two teenagers who have cancer, one of them Hazel Grace Lancaster, and she meets Augustus Waters in her support group class, which she reluctantly goes to. She goes to it for her mother.
Yeah.
The adolescent language in here is terrific. It's very funny, it's very sharp, and it's what keeps the book, I think, on a level that it's not too depressing. They fall in love. She has a book that she is attached to, has read it five times, and she keeps trying to contact the author in Amsterdam to find out what happens to the characters afterwards. And Augustus finds a way to get her to Amsterdam. A surprising visit, unexpected, with the author. He's just an alcoholic, crazy man, which adds great fun. And when they come back to Indianapolis, which is where this takes place, there are some sad things that happen. But there is something about this book that is, it's not depressing. It is incredibly, profoundly just, I don't know what the word is. It's not just involving.
It gets under your skin, though.
Thank you very much.
It does. Yeah.
It does get to you. And you can't forget it. And I wrote about this on the longest chapter, and I had so many people just, you know, respond about it. And clearly it has hit a nerve out there, for especially for the young adults. Mm-hmm. And
give me the title again, would you?
It's called The Fault in Our Stars by John Green.
And now, who is John Green?
Well, he's a yeah. local guy, isn't he? He's from Kenyon.
Is he from Kenyon?
Ohio guy. Yeah,
well,
I think he went to Kenyon College, either Kenyon or Denison, I think.
Well, he may have. I haven't read that on his.
I think he's an Ohio author.
Well, if you're listening, John, call us and tell us where you went to school.
In Indianapolis, but he very well could have.
Yeah, it generated a lot of interest. I had students at Capitol. That was one of the few times I've seen students at Capitol make an overt effort to, like, order books and get one and be really excited when they're coming in the mail and sharing them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have an email from John who reminds us that the author of Destiny of the Republic, the book about the Garfield assassination, was Candace Millard. That is a great read, and it certainly was a great, for me it was at least. But he goes on to say she wrote an even better nonfiction book called River of Doubt. It's an account of Teddy Roosevelt's expedition to explore the Amazon, one of his favorite books of recent years, River of Doubt by Candace Millard. Thank you, John, for that. We have several people on hold, and as soon as we get their information, we'll be happy to share that with you. But I want to ask you, Kevin, about Nicholson Baker. You brought a Nicholson Baker
book. Yes, I stumbled upon Nicholson Baker, and we've talked about him before. In fact, if I put a mini library in my front yard, I was just thinking I'd put his book, The Anthologist. Nicholson Baker's novel, The Anthologist, which is a wonderful read about a poet. Mm-hmm. This is a collection of essays, The Way the World Works. It's a little uneven, but one of the essays, the book is worth it for the essay called Truckin' for the Future, which is a long essay about this bizarro world of weeding. It's a term of art in libraries, weeding. That is, how do libraries make the decision to throw away books? And some libraries keep records of what they throw away, some don't, and some throw away the records of what they've thrown away. And this is his investigation of that practice and why they do it and how terrible it is. And he investigates some of the books that were actually thrown away, like the last copy of a first edition of something written by Darwin was tossed out. He says it's amazing. But he talks just about that whole process, trucking for the future. And it's, of course... He's very doubtful about the futures of libraries. Ultimately, he says, you know, libraries are being taken over by people who have backgrounds in business and technology. They're not caretakers of the book. And libraries are becoming more and more these big open spaces with a lot of, you know, outlets for technology. And he gives the example of the San Francisco Public Library, who built this beautiful new library and then found out they didn't have enough room for all the books in the previous library, so had just threw away 200,000 books, and he followed them. They put them in a truck, and the truck just drove them to a landfill and dumped them in the landfill. So it's called The Way the World Works. And it's worth it just for his essays on the book, the future of the book, and electronic books like the Kindle. He has a really good essay in there on it as well.
Well, didn't he write Double Fold?
Yeah, Double Fold, about the reason to preserve newspapers. Yeah.
We have a call from Chris in the North End. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hello?
Go ahead.
Hey, you know, I want to recommend a really good book simply because of the perspective it's told from. I can't remember the author's name, but the book was called Germania. And the reason this book really gets under my skin is because it's a post-World War II novel told about a handful of Germans trying to get the Reich back together. The reason this book really stands out is because it's told from the perspective of Nazis. And, you know, normally you have this cartoonish evil attitude about these people, and obviously the evil that they committed was unbelievable. However, it's an interesting exercise to step back and realize that these are human beings and that anybody could make those kinds of actions given the right situation. And that's what really comes across in this book.
That's it sounds like a real thought-provoking, troubling book. Yeah, Germania.
It's very disturbing.
Yeah. Chris, thanks for the recommendation. Germania is the book that Chris recommends to us. We have a call from Mark in Columbus. Hello, Mark.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. I'm glad that you mentioned the John Green book. I'm a really big fan of his. And if you like The Fault in Our Stars, I'd highly recommend checking out Paper Towns. I think that was from a couple years ago. Kind of, it's about some students that are in their senior year of high school and kind of what goes on at the end of that. And one of the love interest of the main character invites him out for this like night of mischief and then disappears right before graduation. And it's kind of him and his friends decide that they have to go try to find him. And it's almost kind of a mystery type novel, but I thought it was really, really good and kind of a nice coming of age novel.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. We appreciate it.
Yep.
Thanks for the call. Did you know any of those authors that we're talking about? I love it when we find people we've never heard of. And you were so enthusiastic, Cassie, about John Green. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you knew about him or not, but how do these books get to you? I'll ask you both that. Books that, you know, the authors aren't well known mm-hmm. yet. Did you just pick them up? That happens to me a lot. I just pick mm-hmm. things off the shelves and all of a sudden I'm in love.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the ways, if I recall correctly, that John Green marketed himself and got his name out there is he had like a YouTube series, a little
comedy bits he did
were incredibly popular and went viral on YouTube. And so he was able to get his name out for those. He was associated with those.
It's the Vlog Brothers.
Yeah, the
YouTube.com Vlog Brothers. Something that he does with his brother or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how this book came to me, to be honest with you. My sensors are out in so many different mm-hmm. areas with publications and online, and somewhere I read something that flared something in me that said, you need to read this book. And I can't remember where it was, though. But a lot of times it has to do through my travels online, through my travels of reading Kirkus, reading Publishers Weekly, to word of mouth, to the Times Literary Supplement. I will sometimes also see where something pops up consistently. Or it may simply be like with Rachel Joyce. Here this was her first novel. Here I knew that she was long listed for the Booker. But there was something that about the story that made me think there's something here that I want to take a look at. So some of it has to do with instinct, but it is a lot of combing horizontally a lot of many surfaces.
Kevin, how about you? How do books get to you that, you know, that well, aren't sent to you or by John Irving or something?
Yeah, right. Well, I'm really, you know, I'm lucky and I have an advantage in that, you know, I teach a lot of students and then the students go off into MFA programs and often their associates or colleagues in the MFA programs will publish something or know something or they'll have a visiting author come into the program and they'll tell me about him and I've never heard of this person before. So that's a way it helps me keep up on what the latest developments are and what new writers are coming through. For instance, we talked about Luke Geddes last time and his first collection of short stories. But that's really good for me to keep me in sort of the scene of what's on the cutting edge. So that's where I get a lot of my information.
Well, following that up, Kevin, I know you're a professor at Capital University, which is mostly undergraduates, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What are your kids reading? What are your students reading?
Well, they're reading a book. What's popular now is Arkansas by John Brandon. Brandon's an interesting phenomenon, a McSweeney's author. Arkansas is his first novel, but then he wrote one called Citrus County, and he has his latest one is out, but it's not quite as popular. But I know they're reading that, and they're trying to push me to read that, so I've got to put that on my list. They're reading John Green. I know that was a big one there. Brandon is a big one. They'll bring in short stories collections. Ron Curry is a really interesting guy. He wrote his first short story collection, God is Dead. That's an interesting short story collection. That caught on, and they're reading that in graduate school for sure. So that's what I get, people who have their MFAs are coming back. That's what happens with a lot of MFA students. They come back and they do adjunct work, and so I get to talk to them that way, and they're back in town. And a lot of them are publishing their own books, and that's exciting.
And we have a call from Rodney in Delaware with a recommendation. Hello, Rodney.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just have a book that I recommend to everybody, and every time I give it to some of my neighbors, it never comes back.
Yeah, there you go.
It's called Milagro Beanfield War, and I don't recall the name of the author right now.
We got some sighs of happiness from our panel when you mentioned that title. I know that's been around for a while, and that book is dearly loved by a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, it was also made into a film.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rodney. The Milagro Beanfield War, and we don't know the author offhand, but obviously for a lot of people, that was a great read. Dana in Delaware has sent us an email. The book that she would put out for her neighbors is The Idiot's Guide to Landscaping.
That's a good one. Yeah.
You got to love Dana. That's great. And if she ever saw my house, she'd probably just shudder and keep walking.
I don't need that guide. I'm already an idiot.
That's right. If it were me, I'd put in Dominic Dunn and Anna Karenina, but that's, those are sort of my time. I'm sorry Dominic died not writing any more of his sort of vicious New York Society books, because they're a lot of fun. We have about 2 minutes left, Kevin and Cassie, so any last thoughts to help us wrap up here?
I was just going to say, didn't you mention that you're a Dennis Lehane?
I am, very much so.
Well, he has a new book coming out October 2nd called Live by Night,
yes.
So I will...
Yes,
put that
thank
on
you
the
for that,
radar
Dennis,
for you.
I'm a big fan of Dennis Lehane's. And
one last thing.
Good.
If you're looking, again, we should promote poetry and good readable poetry.
Yes.
And I want to give a oldie but goodie here. Neruda, Pablo Neruda's last book of poetry, The Book of Questions. It's the best-selling book of poetry of all time for Copper Canyon Press, which is a big publisher. Mm-hmm. This is a book that was published right before he died in 1970. In fact, some of these poems were written on his deathbed, and they're all questions. That's what's beautiful about it. They're all written in couplets, and they're questions. Like, have you ever noticed that autumn is like a yellow cow? How winter collects so many layers of blue. They're just beautiful questions after questions. It's a great read. Neruda's The Book of Questions. Very inexpensive, great. Used on Amazon. Do yourself a favor
great
and get it.
Chilean composer. Thank you both. Thank you, Kevin Griffith. Thank you, Cassie Rose. Thanks to everybody who called and listened to All Sides Weekend Books. Thank you to Associate Producer Amy Jurevich, All Sides Assistant Producer Corinne Gleckler, All Sides Production Assistants Katie Higgins and Letitia Wiggins, All Sides Volunteer Rose Joe, with video production by Rich and Amber Kaczynski. I'm Christopher Purdy. Thank you, Cassie. Thank you, Kevin. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.